Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're starting the show today by talking about a really interesting project. Our UW-Madison researchers are working on a project to bank the DNA of species in order to save them. And we're talking about the leader of that project. It's just getting underway, by the way. And our guest, Francisco Pellegrini, is a professor of genetics. He's also chair of the UW-Madison Genetics Department in the UW College of Ag and Life Sciences, and is the leader for the UW Biobank Project. We're going to talk with him about that project and about the challenges and also the ethical considerations that go into bioconservation through genetic storage. There's lots to talk about here. And I hope you'll join in as we move through the program today for this hour. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Francisco Pellegrini, welcome. Thanks for being in the studio with me today.
No, thanks very much. Happy to be here.
Let's start by talking about the threats to extinction. I think worldwide, do we even know how many species are under threat?
Oh, right now there's We are at the verge of essentially the rates of extinction are in the span of the next 500 years are predicted to be equal to that of a mass extinction. So it would be the sixth mass extinction, which is essentially 75% of all species. So if you take all species that are endangered or threatened, what you'd call the vulnerable categories, and assume they're not rescued, we literally are at the rates of mass extinction. Mm-hmm. And so that's a lot of species. If we think vertebrates alone, there's 66,000 species, so the 75%. And the larger animals are also, like vertebrates, for example, would be also more vulnerable.
I'm thinking about your research, which is zeroing in on the Great Lakes region, including Wisconsin, of course, and the number of species that just exist in this region. There's got to be, over 1,000 species just in the water alone.
Oh, yeah. I'm not an ecologist. Of course, Wisconsin has many species, which is one of the nice things about thinking about having this project here in Wisconsin. It's also not as complex as, say, the rainforest, right? So one of the ideas of that we are exploring is having a proof of principle model for biopreservation, mm-hmm. which could be at the ecosystem level, basically using land-based ethics, as opposed to, say, this or that species or that animal because it's attractive or because it calls to us. It's rather used a land-based ethics. And so that's why having a location and trying to preserve the actual ecosystem, that location, makes sense. Because then we target everybody and the network, which is essentially what works, is the network.
Yeah. So what works, you can come up with something that works in the Great Lakes region. Hopefully that same process could be applied to other areas.
Exactly. That's right. So one advantage of working in the Great Lakes region is that there is a lot of biodiversity, but there's also it's not as much as another place like a rainforest. And so we could establish a pipeline to show how you could do it in specific locations, right? In an enclosed system. You could say the same about an island like Madagascar or even the Catalina Island, right? Something mm-hmm. small. Isle Royale, anything that you can say you can safeguard the ecosystem, and in its entirety becomes a model.
It makes a whole lot of sense. And your project would preserve the DNA of as many species as possible.
Right. Yeah. So if you think about ecosystem level, it's of course it's extremely challenging, but the idea is to preserve species in a way that is systematic at large scale. a scale that will be valuable, because small scale is not valuable in terms of genetic preservation. And when we talk about DNA, by the way, we're talking about the entire genome. And as it is right now, with the technology that we have, we can sequence DNA, but we really, with the sequence, we, as of now, we cannot, and for a few decades, we will not be able to make cells out of it. So we really are talking about preserving cells, because the cells are what has the DNA. You don't have to change it. It has it. You can even reconstitute a cell with a freeze-dried nucleus, and it works. Right. So what we're talking about when we talk about DNA preservation, we're actually talking about cell sampling at large scale.
So, as I was thinking about this, I have done a little reading on this. It's one of the reasons that the University of Wisconsin can become involved in something like this is that we have a broad range of talents that can be brought to bear. And that's probably, maybe you can talk about that as your project leader of this, kind of yours and others' ideas. Talk about that.
Yeah, exactly. Wisconsin's a great place for starters, with a philosophy of the Wisconsin idea. And yep. Also many environmentalists that come from Wisconsin. And then we have a tremendous expertise on campus that goes from ecology to animal reproduction to communication science and ethics. Right now we have, for example, a grant that's funded by NSF on the responsible use of new technologies. That the principal investigator of that grant, by the way, is Paul Robbins, who's the director of the NELSON, who's leading that overarching effort. And so we have really, and the approach that we're going to talk about is extremely interdisciplinary. So we have all that expertise all the way to stem cell technology, like Jamie Thompson, who was here at Madison. All those technologies, together with animal science, vet science, all that can be integrated into a management pipeline for species preservation and preservation of their health. In a sense, biodiversity is the way that species, and we can talk a lot more about this, is the way that species remain healthy.
Yeah. I was even thinking of Bill Murphy, William Murphy, mm-hmm. as another example. There we go to biomedical engineering. I think he is professor there.
Yeah. Bill Murphy was actually, so we had an interdisciplinary grant from UW-Madison, and Bill Murphy was, in fact, he was the first person that wanted to be in that grant. And so he was he is a collaborator in this project also. He works on biopreservation with mineralized materials. And I think the idea is that this is, if we are going to biopreserve cells, we may need them decades later, and so we need very, very efficient ways in which those cells are going to last those decades. And it's now we're talking about social, economical, political challenges to having those. Having something that's extremely efficient is very helpful. So, for example, keeping cell lines encapsulated in mineralized material, which is what Bill Murphy has pioneered for vaccines and other things, for mRNA, but it can also be done in cell lines, would be a way to have cells at room temperature as opposed to liquid nitrogen, right? So then reduce the carbon footprint, it reduce the cost. Because a lot of these cell lines may be needed 100 years from now, and we won't know that they're needed until they really are needed. So we really need to be efficient and smart about how to do this.
Yeah, I was thinking, I was remembering a story. I mean, there's sub-zero freezers that you find in labs and so forth. Things can happen.
Oh, yeah. Sure, yeah. There's a colleague of mine, Tony Goldberg, at the vet school, and he has a rule that there's every 3 years there's a freezer disaster. So liquid nitrogen is much more is much better, more stable. We were visiting the San Diego Zoo, which has liquid nitrogen tanks, and they have a way that if there's a power loss, essentially everything gets shut down, and I think it lasts frozen. The entire room gets shut down and sealed, and then the samples can last for a week or two. preserved without power.
Yeah. I do remember a story about a California lab that somebody turned off the wrong switch and turned off the freezers or whatever they were, and they lost 25 years of research.
Sure. Yeah, you know, biopreservation is really important. Like if you think about the Svalbard plant seed bank, right? That's in an island north of Norway, right? And that they're using the cold, the natural cold, so for preservation. I've even seen thought about this myself, but I've even seen an article proposing the moon as a place to put samples, right? Just because it would be free cold, essentially.
Oh. I hadn't thought about this.
Yeah.
Well, how far along are you on this now?
We just starting. We are. The idea that samples are important started in the 70s, 80s. San Diego Zoo was one of the pioneers on this.
Yeah.
We're just at the point where some of those samples that were frozen 40 years ago are coming back to us to help the populations, like with the black-footed ferret. This sample that had been frozen for 40 years, that sample had three times more genetic diversity than the existing black-footed ferret, so it's really important to reinvigorize the population. So we're getting to the point where we are starting to understand the importance of that approach. At the time, samples were frozen because the species was near extinction, but we are getting to the point where we understand that, first of all, any species can become extinct, no matter what the size. Yeah. The passenger pigeon is a great example, right?
Yeah.
There were billions in the sky, and they became extinct. And so we understand we also need a lot more samples. There's a minimum number of samples you want to have, or a minimum number of genetic diversity represented in those samples that you want to have a healthy population. So we're talking about thousands of samples. And so now we kind of go, we get to the point where we're proactively thinking that we need to be proactive and that we also are able to amass large groups, interdisciplinary groups that accept that technology. Technology has also has some detractors, understandably. And so we get into the point where we have that momentum. At the moment, we had we were hoping we can biopreserve Wisconsin as a model for essentially a model landscape. We would start with the higher trophic levels going down, and at some point, of course, it becomes a matter of having the land mass. That's the idea. Right now, we have a grant, a pilot from NSF, as I mentioned, and in the grant, we are proposing to do biopreservation of samples from the red fox and from American marten. So we have David Drake, who's in the show. He's as a collaborator in this. And so we are hoping to get 15 samples from each of those species and then just pull them. We'll have a pipeline where we know which sample is which. We know how much in the diversity is in the sample. Genetic diversity is important because it takes 15 samples from a beehive that is in the same area, or bees from the entire state represents a very different, an extreme example, right? So you need to assess the genetic diversity in the sample. Then they will be frozen as pools, and then we want to thaw them back out and re-identify and know we got them. We froze them in a 50-fold efficient, for example, manner, and then we can get them back, right? And so the idea would be, can we biopreserve diversity in sort of aliquots? An aliquot is sort of like a small tube. When you have a large volume, you don't want to freeze them all. You store them in small tubes you can use. And the nice thing about cell lines is that once you get them, they can also reproduce themselves. So, for example, you can get a small piece of skin and get fibroblasts, they're called. And there's cells that grow from skin very easily. They can grow multiple passages, they can also be turned at some point into stem cells and induced pluripotent cells. And those can grow forever. So you could make these aliquots, let's just say 1,000 samples in aliquots of 50. You could use one, but you could regrow it and just put it back in the freezer, essentially. So, and then the idea is, maybe we're getting a little bit ahead, but the idea is that as you monitor biodiversity, if it's needed, let's just say a very large wildfire and there was a large loss of animal life, if you notice, or an individual species, there's a loss in genetic diversity, you could reintroduce that genetic diversity with the genetic diversity in those samples.
Oh, interesting. Our guest today, Francisco Pellegri, professor of genetics, chair of the UW-Madison Genetics Department in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, and a leader of the UW project. It's the Biobank Project. I almost forgot the title of it, the UW Biobank Project, and we're getting into it now. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along here about the work being done and talking about DNA and preserving it and banking it. Should we be doing that? Some people might argue against it, but I think there are some really good reasons for doing this work. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at the UW Biobank Project, where we are UW researchers are studying the Great Lakes region, and they are the goal is to collect the DNA from as many animals as we can come up with, as we can find, to be able to regenerate that species in the future. And we're talking about how that all is working with our guest, Francisco Pellegri, who is leader of the project. And again, join in. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Daniel emailed, how are the DNA samples actually collected? Blood, hair, tissue, or does it vary based on different animals?
Great question. Yeah, thanks. So the in the older days, biobanking of animal species in the wild used to be thought of as involving gametes. And we're talking about sperm, like freezing sperm from any animal, or eggs. But as you can imagine, this is pretty... it's much more involved, if not very highly invasive. The first time I talked to a person, it was a person in Belize, and that's what they were doing with frogs. Right? That seems very invasive, which is something you don't want to do with a large scale, especially with an endangered species or threatened species. So that the one thing that has been transformative is the ability to reprogram cells now into stem cells, so with induced pluripotent cells, which has come in the last couple of decades. So which means that you can take any sample and reprogram it into a stem cell. So this could be it could be a piece of a small biopunching skin. It could be a little bit of blood. It could also be hair follicles, cells around a hair, hair follicles, or around the follicles of feathers. Mm-hmm. You can even get cells out of the lining, the intestinal lining in feces, has cells from the host that you can sequence and actually isolate, or even saliva. So there's many, many ways, and it could be, as you say, species specific. For some species, in certain ways may be better than others. Right now, one way that is helpful, and that's where our foxes, Red Fox and American Marten Project is going in, is to partner with people who will be monitoring the animal anyway and handling the animal anyway, and then getting a very small sample. So, for example, what we're trying to do is getting a very small 4 millimeters. So 4 millimeters is a very tiny amount.
Very tiny.
Very tiny, and literally at the tip of the ear, so that it would be scarless, right? And so, but that would still allow us, and we have collaborators, this laboratory, the Susie sample in the vet school, who can get fibroblast cell lines out of that small amount. And those fibroblast cell lines can be frozen, they can be analyzed for DNAs, they can be stored, they can be pooled, they can be turned into stem cells. And they can be used for to generate an animal. A stem cell can be used either for cloning or to make germ cells and put back into an animal and make gametes again. So that's really the transformational aspect, is the ability to make stem cells right now, which is what scientists in the field worldwide are trying to push for this approach, which really has changed the landscape. It allows us to do it large scale, also without affecting the individuals. You could get just like one of those a tiger in Siberia, you could get just hairs that get caught in like one of these places next to a tree that catches the hair, and then you could, might be able to get cells out of that. So there's very different ways that we're exploring, even potentially DNA or cells in mosquitoes, right? I mean, there's all kinds of ways you could try to get cells.
I was thinking about this. Getting the broad diversity, really, I mean, once you get down to the fact, let's take the white rhino, for example, mm-hmm. which there's only a handful left in the right. world. Now we're getting down to the point, all right, I think there's even some work going on to clone white rhinos. But the problem with that is that the few are there's no diversity there.
Right, exactly. This is what this is what attracted my attention was the story to this topic, because I'm a developmental biologist by training, always interested in conservation. But there was this attempt in the early 2000s to clone an Iberian, a Pyrenean ibex, which had become extinct. And of course, by the time, and there was an attempt of trying to clone it, the clone didn't survive, but it's really what really highlighted is the species had been protected in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. They still could not make it. This is because there's something that happens called the extinction vortex, which is basically that if you're healthy, you are outside of the vortex, the population mm-hmm. is healthy in terms of genetic diversity, you're outside of the vortex. But as soon as you start having issues like inbreeding, and this could be caused by fragmentation, right, you can have lots of animals, but they're fragmented, so effectively the populations are very, very small. Inbreeding and other, it just adds up, and then the populations essentially get sucked into extinction. And so it's
and it doesn't take very many generations for that to occur, or two or three.
No, well, it essentially probably amplifies, right? So at some point, animals are thought to be as functionally extinct. So we were talking about the rhinos. There is the southern white rhinos, they came back from very small numbers. So that's a success story. And presumably the small number of southern white rhinos had enough genetic diversity to now have a reinvigorated healthy population now. But the northern white rhinos could not. And what they have for the northern white rhinos at the San Diego Zoo is, and collaborators, is sperm and eggs and oocytes that are frozen. And what they're thinking is to use those and use the related species, the southern white rhino, as a foster mother for those embryos to allow them to survive. Now, having said that, yes, you are. What we don't want to be in the situation where you have so few samples that even if you get those individuals back, they won't survive again, right? So this is where the concept of having very large samples in the first place comes into play, because then we're not talking about bringing an animal back from extinction when we're talking about when we're talking about biopreservation in a future genetic management strategy. We're talking about monitoring genetic diversity and on way, way before they become threatened, actually reinvigorating the population if needed, precisely for that problem.
Yeah, and so it's hard to almost wrap your mind around it, because you're looking at all these species, thousands of species, really, and is broad, getting as broad a range of variants as possible among those. And somebody's going to say, well, why are you collecting 1,000 samples of a water flea? What the heck is the good of that?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. Well, I think when it gets down to water flea or mosquitoes, it starts to be a little more complicated to argue. But generally, the ecosystem is all interconnected, right? So you can very there is data to back up the idea that by helping one species, you help many species by reinforcing the ecosystem. Ecosystems depend on a large network, and the more varied the network, the stronger the ecosystem is, the ecosystem network. And so we're not just talking about one species, we're talking about the entire ecosystem when we help one species.
You're working with Paul Robbins, and you mentioned Paul's name earlier. He's dean of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. What's that? What has the working with him changed the focus of your project? or has it changed the focus?
Yeah, I think when we first, so Paul had attended some workshops on the use of new technologies for grand challenges, and so he was interested in this approach. And when we first started meeting, the whole concept, for as a big example, is the whole concept of prioritization of species. Why do you choose one species as opposed to another? Why choose a panda as opposed to a gastric frog, right? How do you prioritize species that you target? And so that was a big question, is what is the rationale, the ethics and the rationale for prioritization, right? Because these are going to be efforts. And then at the time, I was just thinking about the technique. I was thinking the technique that we're essentially working with, and in particular in my lab, is yes, we're working outside of the lab to try to get samples, but we're also working, once you have those samples, you need surrogates for the samples to become gametes and individuals. And the surrogates could be a captive population, mm-hmm. or it could be a different species. Yeah. So anyway, I'm telling Paul Robbins, as far as I know, the technique works with related species because they're related enough to be surrogates. Mm-hmm. And so then the idea of somehow it came out, the concept that a location like Madagascar, for example, where all the animals are related 60 million years ago because of the geology, that would be a good model system. And so then the concept of land ethics is what became the rationale for prioritization. And that came from out of that conversation. And then the other thing that I've gotten a lot from my interactions with Paul Robbins is the emphasis on indigenous sovereignty, so that we have we're engaged. Any effort, any biopreservation effort is engaged with sovereignty of indigenous nations, and that's also something that we're working that he's leading.
Yeah, it's all kind of Aldo Leopold ethic.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Comes into play mm-hmm. here.
Right.
Well, it's we could probably talk some more about tribal concerns. I was thinking about, I read somewhere, I can't remember where now, but the biodiversity of lands that are owned by or managed by native indigenous populations, mm-hmm. it's like 80% of all right. of the of what we have.
Yeah, exactly.
In terms of diversity.
That's right. I think globally about 70 to 80% of biodiversity is in local indigenous lands. Yeah.
It certainly makes a lot of sense then to be working with our indigenous populations for a whole host of reasons.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Our guest today, Francisco Pellegri, we're talking about the bio project, the biobank project, I should say, that's the UW is working on right now. Just sort of, it's in its earliest stages, I guess we should say. Francisco Pellegri is the leader of that project. And questions or comments, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email to talk@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Louise in Dodgeville, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. In regards to the Great Lakes or Midwest region, I was wondering what your guests considered maybe like foundational or keystone species. Like I know oak trees are kind of a keystone of the ecosystem, and sturgeon are, you know, eons old. So in terms of collecting DNA and prioritizing, would there be a focus in the Midwest?
Yeah,
great question. So the concept of biopreservation has been long established with plants, and in a sense, we're trying to recreate and then gain acceptance and momentum for the animal biopreservation. So in terms of animals, there are our pipeline, one thing that we're interested in is to set up a pipeline for the entire ecosystem. So the pipeline doesn't necessarily depend on threatened species. In a sense, it's almost better to establish a pipeline with species that are not as threatened, just because they'd be easier access and so on. So that's why red foxes, American martens, although those are crucial in terms of conservation as well, those are part of our pipelines. In terms of animal targets that are easy to think about in terms of threatened status, we do have a number of species in the Midway, in the Great Lakes, like the rusty patch bumblebee, which is critically endangered, the Carner blue butterfly, which is endangered. The butterfly is interesting too because it depends on specific bushes, which is the lupine bush, which really emphasizes that we can't just think about animals. We have to think about the entire ecosystem, including the plants that are related and interdependent. I think you mentioned the sturgeon. There's also a number of turtles, like the wood turtles, Blanding's turtles, whooping crane, of course, with the Crane Foundation doing extremely important work. And so on. There's a number of bird species, Kirtland's warbler, the Great Lakes piping plover, there's a number of bats that are endangered, and so those would be the targets that one would think initially to prioritize. But at the same time, we are thinking about the entire ecosystem. Any animal could become extinct years from now. This is the time to get the samples when there's a lot of animals. So the easiest projects are the ones that are available are the ones that we should pursue as well. And so, I think it will probably be a combination of prioritization and also, in a sense, going through the various species. Perhaps higher trophic levels going down.
Louise, does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Appreciate the call.
Thank you.
You can join in too, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. And that habitat, I mean, a lot of species are lost because of a loss of habitat. Should we bring back these animals before restoring the habitat? That's a question.
Right. Well, yeah, that's a question for me, or?
Well, it is a question.
Sure. Yeah, I don't think it makes any sense, right? You need to have the habitat, and this is why it's. I think when we're talking about biopreservation of samples, we have to keep in mind that they will be almost like a joke to have if we have no habitat, right? And the other thing that the approach is, so in a sense, they remind us how important habitats are. Right? The nice thing about this approach is we're not trying to recreate a habitat. We're just trying to keep it so that, again, you monitor genetic diversity of a particular species or a couple of species might be going down, you reintroduce genetic diversity, keeping the habitat healthy. It's not to create a habitat from scratch. It would be very hard, if not impossible. So that's there are some species, for example, like the golden toad in Monteverde in Costa Rica, that was the first species that was widely thought of as a victim of climate change loss, and it was quite publicized. There were other aspects like this invasive fungus and so on, but it became endangered in Monteverde. But the habitat is still there. So this is a case where, I know we're not talking about bringing back species, right?
No, that's all right.
But this is a case where there is a habitat and the species is not there anymore, right? So clearly habitat is essential. That's what we don't want to do is miss opportunities to have tools that we can help to strengthen ecosystem networks, species health, and habitats.
Yeah. You mentioned Costa Rica, of course, and for the past decade, you've led field trips to Costa Rica with your students, which sounds like really interesting, but fun too.
It's super fun. We've done it for a while. We had to stop during COVID, but we're hosted by organization Tropical Studies. We go to three different ecosystems on spring break, about 20 students from campus, and the ecosystems are a rainforest, a cloud forest on the mountains, and then on the other side of the mountains, a dry seasonal marshland. And they really see how the ecosystem can change so much in such a short stretch of geographical stretch, and also the interconnection of even the climate change and how the cloud forest has been affected by that, because just the cloud forest in itself is so dependent on the air currents that are also affected by heat. So they really get to see. The last time we went there, we actually saw an ocelot. And I completely flipped out because cats are very hard to see. But we had a student with a huge zoom, and he took the photo. And like, I could not believe that little thing that we were seeing was an ocelot. But we all got to experience, and it's really quite transformational. Some of the students have never even traveled abroad before.
Yeah. I understand. Led some tours myself of students to. Trinidad, I understand well how transformative that could be. Mm-hmm. Did those trips have any influence or get you thinking along the lines of this project? Tell us.
Sure.
How.
Yeah. In many ways, I think one of the initial purposes of the trip was to get collaborators there. So now we know people in Costa Rica, for example. But one thing that, as an example, and we do work in the Great Lakes, but we also have collaborators in Nepal, for example, or mm-hmm. now in Costa Rica, and you could potentially think about the same kind of approaches in those areas with collaborators. And these kinds of even trips that are educational trips are really important to make those connections and also building trust between people and the communities there. But one thing that struck me maybe the last couple of times, going to Costa Rica every year we go, is how the Costa Rica has this mountain range, and the mountain range has a cloud forest in it. And in a sense, it's really the cloud forest is like an island in land, right?
Yeah.
And which is essentially the animals, if you have climate change, and that's changing the location of the border with the cloud forest, that might be shrinking the geographical mm-hmm. location to the point where it might become the island might go away. So in a sense, it made me realize how this ecosystem was really quite enclosed, and there are a lot of species that are adjusted to that range, that mountain range, and they have nowhere to go. And so in that sense, it's almost like having Madagascar, right, or having another island. Yeah.
Francisco Pellegrini, our guest today. He is leader of the UW Biobank Project. Love to hear from you. I see we have some emails. We'll get to those. And we've got open lines, and you can join in with your question or comment at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Francisco Pellegrini, who is the leader of the UW Biobank Project. He's a professor of genetics and actually chairs the Department of Genetics at the UW-Madison. Again, questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Before we take these emails, you plan to have your students in Costa Rica collect the DNA of animals from the blood of mosquitoes.
Yeah, so we, right, so this was a project where we wanted to do some sampling. But understandably, local communities, local countries, and they have very strong regulations against just going and taking samples, right?
Sure.
So then we wanted to have a project that would be interesting to students. And it would also be pretty inoffensive in terms of the regulations. And so we came up with this. And mosquitoes are used already for, they're already used in Africa you can identify what the mosquitoes, the host of that, the mosquito bites. So that blood meal has DNA that you can track it. And you can tell this mosquito beat this a pig first, then a dog, and so on. That can also be used to track COVID, and I think in Honduras they were using mosquitoes to track COVID. So basically, there's blood meal in the mosquitoes, and the idea is that they could find animals that would be hard to find, right? So, for example, we were there in one of the reserves, and they had a footprint of a of the danta, tapir. Right, this large mm-hmm. mammal is in danger, and everybody was super excited, but they haven't seen it. Right? But a mosquito would find it. So I think certainly for DNA, and mosquitoes may become important to track, essentially in a way to track environmental DNA, assess genetic diversity, but potentially, and with the caveat that, yes, as soon as the mosquito bites, those cells might start to get degraded, but potentially we could also get some cells out of blood-sucking mosquitoes or leeches and so on. So, but it was a project that we could do in that those nine days, and so we have that as a project, as a target project to carry out.
That's pretty cool. But it did remind me, since I think we now have a new Jurassic Park movie.
Right, yeah. I think I didn't think of that. And actually, the idea of mosquito, maybe it was, I did see that movie early on in my life, so I wasn't thinking, I'm sure I saw that at one point, but the idea of using mosquitoes actually came from the London Zoo Consortium for Biobanks, where they listed bee samples as being in an aphid. So they were counting bee samples as being in the aphid that sucked the blood out of the bees. And that's where the idea for a mosquito came from for our project. Not Jurassic Park, as far as I understand.
Oh my goodness. We had a question. How are you safeguarding the DNA info that would be collected so perhaps it's not used for profit, perhaps?
Right. So the question is whether, how do we make sure it's not used for profit? I think that's
the basically. Question.
Yeah. Well, the I think that the efforts that we would do would be certainly dedicated to, with the understanding that they're for countries or organizations to use for conservation. This is a technique that. That is there that can be used for conservation genetics, which is hard to imagine how to get it monetized, right? So when we're talking about this kind of technique, we don't expect any kind of monetization. There's always a chance that people use genetic technology and genetic knowledge to monetize. Right now, for example, glowfish is a great example, right? People can make transgenics glowfish or any kind of animal and then sell it. There's not a lot of regulations on that. There, in my opinion, there should be more. But when it comes to preservation of endangered species, what we're doing is non-GMOs, non-gene edited samples that essentially represent the population. Having said that, too, countries like Costa Rica, understandably, they don't want samples, or many other countries, or like Nepal is the same, they don't want samples to be taken necessarily, unless they agree to it, to be taken out of the country, precisely because they put so much effort in their ecosystem to preserve them. And so for them, it's part of their economy as well. And they want to safeguard those from not being taken advantage of, not being exploited. And so that's one reason why we need to work within the guidelines of those countries to respect that and make sure that that any effort that doesn't get inappropriately monetized.
And just to go along with that, and Paul Robbins is probably could talk even more about this, but the close relationship there is a close relationship being developed with indigenous populations. And could you talk about that at all?
Sure. Yeah. Well, the grant that we are part of now is a large it's a pilot grant, but it's a large group that involves Paul Robbins, who's a principal investigator, and people in philosophy department who are bioethicists, as well as members of Native communities. And we are working with Native nations, trying to have interactions with Native nations or have a dialogue with them to make sure that any, and this is something that's having worldwide. In fact, the pioneers are in New Zealand. And it has also been formalized with the Nagoya Protocol, is the respect of sovereignty of local communities and indigenous communities. And so the idea is that the samples in local indigenous communities' land are belong to those communities, in the sense that any use or even storage of those samples has to be needs to have a dialogue with those parties which are the main stakeholders.
And I think just for the country as a whole, we've not done this. This is in my mind a good way to go about this, working with the people who are in the particular country or in with the particular indigenous population that owns or controls an area that you want to respect them, and you work hand in glove with those folks.
Exactly.
Yeah. Colleen and Madison called, couldn't stay with us. They have identified a couple of endangered species of trees in Madison. Could this biobanking project help bolster tree populations?
Yeah, there. The biobank biopreservation project we're talking about is with animals because there's a need to start that at a large scale. The tree populations, so there's lots of seed banks, many seed banks around the world. And so the concept of banking seeds is long established there are a lot of efforts for tree. I don't know which specific trees you're talking about, but there's a lot of people on campus and across Wisconsin that would be taking care of that. One thing that we're hoping to do is raise visibility of the animal biobank as much as it would be for a plant biobank. Because generally speaking, when you talk about a plant biobank, everybody agrees, oh, that makes a lot of sense. You preserve mm-hmm. seeds, you prevent strains, you prevent species, native plants, and so on. But then the concept of, and partly it's because it's more natural, because it's sure. perceived as more natural. There's seeds that have that role, and all we do is store those mm-hmm. seeds. But then the animal biobank is something that is harder to understand and less seen in that same context, because even though the methods are different, you may have to freeze them in a different way, the principle is the exact same, the purpose is the exact same, which is to keep those populations healthy. Right. So there's a lot of efforts and plans. And as I was saying before, with the corner blue butterfly and the lupine grass, they're integrated too. There's also frogs in Costa Rica that depend a certain kind of bromeliad to lay their eggs and so on. There's lots of examples where those are. So we definitely, one of our goals is to integrate ourselves in the framework of plant biobanks, which are much more long established.
Yeah. And hopefully at some point we'll maybe with Bill Murphy's research be able to freeze dry.
Exactly. This was the goal, is to turn the cells into essentially seeds, and maybe you just can store them in a basement or something, that you don't need liquid nitrogen or anything like that.
And after we're long gone, 100 years from now, those same materials could be brought out and used.
Yeah, exactly. There's also people at the Smithsonian right now working with freeze-dried tissues, and they also can be essentially regenerate into cells that can be used for to create animals.
How many folks on campus at the UW are working on this project?
We have about 40 people, a group of 40 faculty who have been part in the project and various proposals. Actively right now, probably about a dozen that are active in this current proposal, but we had a larger proposal. If we can get this more momentum, we have about 40 people. Because if you think about it, any project that you have field work could be coupled to also a biopreservation project.
You're very enthusiastic and about it, Francisco, and I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today to talk about it. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks very much, and thanks for all the callers.
Hopefully we'll get you back, and we can, hopefully there's progress down the line, and we can come back and talk about it some more.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm sure we have some interesting stories.
And bring Paul into it as well. Francisco Pellegri is a professor of genetics and is the leader of the UW Biobank Project. It was really fun talking with him about it and interesting. And we'll get him back down the road and we'll find out how things are progressing. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, I think one of the joys in life for me is to be outside, and especially when there's no traffic and maybe I'm in a woods or I'm just walking through my neighborhood early in the morning, as I do most mornings, and hearing the birds' songs. And there's such a variety of songs that I hear and I enjoy. And I bet you enjoy hearing those songs as well. There's been some really cool research done on bird calls, bird songs, and really bird songs that are heard around the world. And one of the people who's done that work is Sathya Chandra Sagar. Sagra.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I got that wrong. Sagra. Oh, my goodness. I even practiced that beforehand, and I still got it wrong.
No, you didn't. That's perfect. It's quite a long name. So.
Well, I tell you what, Sathya, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Sathya is a conservation scientist. He's a field ornithologist and a recent PhD graduate from the UW-Madison's Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, and is the lead author on this fascinating global study of bird songs. And I hope you'll join in. We'll hear a few bird songs along the way, but if you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join in. Number's 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Welcome to the show, Sathya. How did you get interested in birds and bird songs?
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Larry. Yeah, this is a pleasure to be here. And yeah, similar to you, I've always loved birds, and my introduction to ecology and conservation and, you know, my life itself as a scientist dates back to the time when I listened to birds. And I was always fascinated by them. And finally, after, you know, nearly 26 years, I think I got this opportunity to kind of use, science to look at, you know, why bird calls, or why does it sing a certain way, and how can that be used, you know, in conservation of theirs. So, yeah, that's how it started.
And it's a really interesting idea. And this is a remarkable, I think, global study.
Yeah.
How the heck were you running all over the world capturing bird songs? I don't think so.
No, definitely not. No, this study that we conducted, I was the lead author, as you said, but also this was a collaborative effort between people like Anna Pigeon, Maya Pershey, Akash, Ben, they were all from, UW-Madison, and Chan from Utah, and my advisor, Zuzana Burivalova. And none of us went around the world collecting all the bird songs. But in fact, we used fantastic, data set that is actually collected by the community scientists, or, previously called as citizen scientists, who are just birders and who are not professional ornithologists, but probably better birders than many scientists, and went out and collected data for nearly 8,000 or 9,000 species of birds all over the world. And it's freely available in an online platform called Xenocanto. And that's the only reason why I was able to do such very global research.
So Xenocanto is, I guess you'd call it a bird watching repository.
Yes, it's like a bird, like a bird recording repository, I would say. Yes. You know, people collect information on their calls and songs and then put it there. And then there are volunteers who go through these songs to see to grade them about, you know, what quality it is in, and A being the highest and DE being not the best. And yeah, and it's out there for people to use it and listen to it and enjoy, and like me also with enjoying studying them. Yeah.
So why do birds call?
I mean, for a variety of reasons, I guess. I mean, you know, there is, research has gone to say why do they call and want to make territory, saying that this is my place, you know. So I'm here and to show their presence to another males to say that don't come into my territory. And also to show to the female, saying that, well, I'm here and look it out and check it out. But also sometimes I think philosophically they just do it because they love. Also, I think because, you know, the way we sing sometimes and we talk to the world. And I think there's also an aspect of that.
I agree with you. I mean, I sometimes observe birds singing. And to me, it looks like they're just for the joy of it.
Yeah, they're having fun. Yeah, that's true.
So why is it important to study?
We knew that, you know, birds are singing and there's a whole field of bioacoustics, which is basically trying to use the sounds of the nature to study either the landscape or the forests. And the group I was part of, Zuzana Burivalova's Sound Forest Lab, uses bioacoustics where we collect the sounds of the forest or collect the sounds of the landscape, to know whether it's healthy or not, to conserve it, to understand it. And bird songs are a big part of this soundscape per se, which is like all the sounds in a landscape, right? But while we knew that, you know, like sounds of birds is a big part of the soundscape, but we didn't really know what are those traits that underlie the wide variability. Like, why can't all the birds sing at the same frequency, for example? Like, why should they have different frequencies? And what are those evolutionary factors and ecological factors that shape this frequency differences and this diversity that birds have? And then, you know, so before I used these bioacoustic tools to study how good the forest is, I wanted to study why they are like that, so that I can use it in the conservation of the forest. So that was my first goal. And
you talk about frequency character. I've read some of your writing on that. You talk about frequency characteristics.
Yes. Yes.
So what does that actually mean? Describe what that means.
Yeah, well, frequency characteristics, here we use something like a minimum frequency. Like, you know, if a bird sings, it always has a range of frequencies. You know, many of the species have multiple songs or, you know, a range of frequencies. So we used some of the chosen ones, like the minimum frequency, the lowest of the frequency, maximum frequency, which is like the highest, and the dominant frequency, where there's a lot of frequency characters, frequency energy. And then we also looked at the range, you know, like the difference in the minimum to maximum, how wide that is, basically to look at do they have a huge range, for example? Mm-hmm. So these are the characteristics that we analyzed.
It's interesting. I mean, I think today a lot of this type of research, I'm not sure how precise or possible it could have been maybe 30 years ago. I mean, the equipment that we have, what you were using some pretty sophisticated sound equipment, I'm assuming.
So I think there's two aspects of it. One is the sound equipment that was used by the recorders, like the people out there recording. And that has, developed quite a bit. The reason why we're having such clarity of voice, give us in mind, being, recorded right now. And at the same time, I think the computational power with computers and analysis that we can do with these have just been amazing. So I think there's been no better time where we can use this amazing natural history data set that collected by these people with the computational power to understand these global patterns.
So all these 8,000 species, I'm thinking of just how difficult it must have been, or how did you go about separating out this of all of these species, or did you zero in on just some of the 8,000, or was all of the 8,000?
No, it was. I mean, there are about 11,500, odd species, and we focused only on about 8,900 because we could not get the and so we did focus on 8,900. It was 77% of species, But also, we were not just randomly looking into, you know, what we can find from the data, but we had a specific hypothesis that we wanted to test, because I'm not the first person who has tried to, you know, disentangle this. So, you know, for over a century, people have been wondering, like, what is the relationship between how big of a bird is and their call? And does the beak size affect the calls? And whether there's a difference in call frequency characteristic between tropics and temperate regions. You know, so many of these things people have pondered over the years. So I want to kind of try to get an answer for that.
Well, did you find any find birds making sounds in surprising ways, or ways that were surprising to you, at least?
Well, yes, there were like surprising, you know, kind of results. But and some of the things that I already hypothesized, you know, for example, one of the things was we were thinking, well, you know, a bird will, like a large bird, will always call in a lower frequency, is what we had assumed. And after looking at 8,000 species, we found that yes, they do. That if, you know, there's a strong relationship between body size and the call frequency. And at the same time, we also found that there's something called, you know, acoustic size exaggeration, is when like a smaller bird wants to show off, saying that it's quite larger than it is. So it makes an effort to reduce its call frequency so that other individuals or other species that are listening to it will realize, oh, okay, that must be a really large bird. So that acoustic size exaggeration was found by a few species before. But then now with this large data set, we realize that, well, there is a lot of evidence for this to be shown across the board of species. And that was quite fascinating. So to see that.
Sathya Chandra Sagara, our guest today, and we're talking with him about his research, along with some other people, of bird songs and birds, bird talk, I guess you could say it in a way. 8,000 species of birds they've analyzed, and they've got some really fascinating results. We'll hear some of those sounds coming up, and also I want to look at the takeaways eventually from all of the research, because I think that is really fascinating to me. You can join in, question, comment, give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. We're looking into some research that has been done on, well, actually a global study of bird songs help us explain the reasons why these sounds are made. And our guest today was the leader, certainly the leader of the research on it, Sathya Chandra Sagara, our guest today, and I'm having some fun listening to him. I hope you are as well. Michael emailed to ask about birds that mimic other birds that mimic the sounds of machinery, like the superb
lyrebird.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of species that do mimic. And they are fantastic. And I know that, so there are species that mimic other bird songs. There are species that mimic, as you said, you know, machinery and fire. And I think it all happens in their repertoire itself. You know, like it becomes part of who those species are. Not all of them can mimic, and some can, and some do. And that, you know, and however, like, I was also fascinated by these birds, because they can mimic, but at the same time, they can't mimic, you know, super high variability, for example. You know, like, yeah, you know, like, you know, these lyrebirds might not be able to do a frequency as low as, for example, an ostrich, you know, is, yeah, like super low frequency, or very high frequency, like some of the hummingbirds that we have. So, But yeah, they do. They do
within,
mimic
within their range.
Yes, but some birds do push the limit of range, and what we say with what we have done in our study is not look into like species by species, but more of a general pattern across the world. So there is quite a bit of variation, you know, when we look at this pattern. So it would not be wrong to say that that lyrebirds do fall into that category of ooh, they are speciality, you know. Like we know that birds tend to have a certain range, but these might have a huge range. Yeah.
Colleen emailed to ask why robins seem to have a song for when it's raining. That's interesting. I hadn't noticed that.
That's well, I guess I mean they do sing when, you know, when it's raining or not raining, and I'm not very sure whether they will have a special song while during singing, but possibly they do, and I'm not very sure. Sorry about that. But I definitely possibly something a really amazing research project to look into in the future. Yeah.
Well, habitat, you did kind of, in a way, study habitat. And how can habitat influence the calls that birds make?
Yeah, so so the initial hypothesis that we wanted to test was something called acoustic adaptation hypothesis, meaning, you know, there's been these theories that, well, the density of a landscape where a species is, will that kind of force the species to have a certain kind of frequency? Like a very dense habitat, you know, might, you know, a species might want to have a low frequency or a high frequency or something like that. And we wanted to test that relationship. But what we found was the vegetation density is not a big factor. However, what we found out that irrespective of the vegetation density, just the habitat itself does make a big difference. One of the things that we saw was, for example, you know, species that are associated with riverine habitats, like stream gorgers or mm-hmm. right next to streams, they tend to have a really high frequency, and it makes sense. You know, for example, you know, you are walking in a woodland, for example, in the Barabo mm-hmm. Hills, and you're going closer to the stream gorge, and that's where you'll tend to hear like really high frequency species like winter wren, for example. And this is because the ambient sounds, like the streams, have a very low frequency sound, like the ambient noise itself. So these species want to stand out, you know, they don't want to talk amongst each other with the same frequency. So they want to be loud and say, well, I'm still here despite the background sound. So in a way, that does make a big difference.
I bet Lee's got a winter wren song. Have you got the...
Yeah,
and that's a different frequency.
Yeah, it's just amazing frequency, yeah.
Compared to, like, a rushing water.
Yep, yeah, compared to, definitely. Because if it's a rushing water and a species has the same frequency, then it's just...
It's not going to be heard.
It's not going to be heard. No, definitely not. So I think, so yeah. So maybe the question from Colleen, I think, you know, uh-huh. saying that, so the rain does have an ambient sound. You know, so it does have a rustling sound. It does have a thundering sound that kind of muffles the sound at the back. And robin, if it wants to show off and I'm still here and I can still change my voice modulation, it might change its frequency. And birds tend to do that. You know, they can change their, you know, they can use at a higher frequency within their range. But they can tend to use their higher frequency call notes or low frequency call notes in their repertoire to show off, saying that, well, you know, it's raining, but I'm still here.
I'm still here. That's a really good point. Willem in Colfax has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I always look forward to in the spring when the return of, we have a brown thrasher that always returns to the same oak tree, it seems like. And they make such a long string of calls that I think are in the, I think they might be mockingbirds in the group, and they just, it goes on and on, and it's so beautiful.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, they are fantastic. I mean, brown thrashers have an amazing repertoire of calls and songs, and certainly one of the best here in the temperate regions.
We might even have a brown
beautiful.
Yeah, beautiful. There you go, Willem. You hear, you got to hear them again.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Ed in Central Wisconsin called but couldn't stay with us. But Ed said they used to hear more frequently whippoorwills. And are those birds on the decline? And I believe they are.
Yeah, and I think this brings to this whole topic of, like, you know, conservation, the threats that these birds are facing. Is, I think for me, there are the two different things. Like, for example, like a person who just, you know, just texted, and I think it, you know, you're not just connected to the landscape just through the forest of just the stones and the grasslands, but also through the sounds of the landscape. You know, when you lose a whippoorwill, you also lose a whippoorwill song. And that means that there's a big part of you, your presence there also is lost due to the loss of that species. And this is happening all over the world. I mean, whippoorwill's population is going down because of the habitat loss that they depend on. And the same thing we hear reverberate all over the world. I mean, sometimes in really good forests, we are also losing these amazing species because they sing well. Like, for example, in Southeast Asia, I mean, I'm giving examples of all over the world because of the global study, that in Southeast Asia, you know, already species are losing their habitat. And what's left of the habitat where the species have to be present, we are losing these, you know, beautiful songbirds because of pet trade. The people there love the bird songs, like the callers today, so much that they want to keep the birds as pets, wild birds as pets in cages. And so you have this double problem for these species. You're losing the habitat, and also the forest are empty and silent. It's very eerie because when I was there studying bird songs in the landscape and how that pet trade is affecting them, there was nothing. It was silent in many places, you know. So it's so nice to come, you know, come here and go to a forest and at least you know hear a brown thrasher, for example, or a winter wren. Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking about this too. If you if there's an area that has always had certain types of birds residing there, and suddenly you're not hearing those anymore. I mean, habitat may be the issue, but it could be something else too.
Yep. That is true, and that's exactly you know, how bioacoustics, like, you know, is used to study a problem. I mean, you know, it's like just like us, you know, if you're in a house and if you're hearing your mom or dad talk, or your, you know, sister or brother, you know that they're present. But if they're not speaking or talking, then they're not there. That something is wrong. I mean, they have gone out, for example, or, you know, they're just not present. So it's the same for a habitat. You know, when you listen to them, if the species that were there all the time are lost, if the habitat is lost, yes, that's one reason. But also climate change right now is a big, big issue. The habitat could be same, you know, it's changing slowly, but species might not cope up with that rising temperature. So they might move to a different place, or there could be mismatch in what they eat, for example, the phenology. So, I mean, there is this wonderful bird songs all over the world that really make us happy, but at the same time, we are losing this amazing diversity of bird songs. Yeah.
Michael emailed to say that European starlings sing at frequencies above what people can hear. Do the recording devices that are designed for humans capture those very high frequencies?
Yes, there are birds and there are species out there that do, you know, sing and make vocalizations above, you know, hearing frequencies. You know, so we as humans, normally, we can hear from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz, but above that would be ultrasonic. And yes, we might not be able to hear, but there are recorders and microphones out there that can record these calls and songs. And for example, most of the bats use ultrasonic, and elephants use infrasonic. So, that we do. we can listen to them and we can record them.
And just as commenting, Beverly emailed to say robins definitely have a rain song. They said they've heard it many times when it rains. And I think your response or your comment on the sound pattern, the acoustical pattern that's going on would force them to do that.
Yep. I think so. I think, that's fantastic. Yeah. It's amazing that, that's the beauty of birds being there, and also our connection with the birds is that, now when you're out there, if, for example, if you hear a bird with a higher frequency, you can say that, this could be a smaller bird species because of this study that we have done, or it could be, or if you're walking in the woods and you hear a, sound with, which is a very low frequency, and you could possibly say that could be a very large bird, like a crane or something, or, definitely not a winter wren.
Let's take a large bird. Let's see, great hornbill.
Oh, yes, fantastic.
Found in Southeast Asia.
Yep.
Just sort of a series of deep, what would you call it, grunts?
Yep.
What's going on with that, or why do they do it that?
If you get an opportunity, have a look at them live or online. I mean, these are great hornbills. They're fantastic birds. They're really big, canopy birds, and they in the frugivores, and also they eat insects and other meat, and they're really quite large birds. So. And have really quite a big bill. So that is a classic example of what is happening here, right? Because it's a large bird, it's the frequency that it's using is quite, low. And it helps it to kind of have a, have this bird song heard at a very, wide range, because it needs that very high, large tracts of forest. And at the same time, its beak is also very big. And that also independently, without even the effect of body size, the beak itself makes a big, difference in what frequency you can call with. And what we found was larger beaks tend to be irrespective of your body size, independent of your body size, you will be forced to have a very low frequency. And so that's why, great hornbills, when you listen to them, you will not mistake them for a winter wren, for sure, because they have a very low frequency, very loud, but very low. Yeah. Very reverberating also.
I was trying to think of some other pileated woodpeckers. They have a little bit longer beak or a different shape beak, and their sound is
quite different, and it is loud, but also it has a very kind of a lower frequency when it compared to other woodpeckers, for example, like a downy or a hairy. So
beak size in this case may be the reason for the lower sound.
And still, pileated is still a smaller bird when you compare to the larger birds out there, So, yes, beak size does make a big difference in what low.
Sounds like they're laughing.
Yeah, they're like, well, you'll still not be able to find out, they're just laughing at us because we are not able to find out all the secrets that they have.
Well, it's interesting. So is the shape of the beak then? Is it not only the length, but the shape?
Yeah, it's the overall size. So we measured it as length by breadth by height, how big the beak is. So it's like the overall volume of the beak. So it was like how big the beak would be, for example. Yeah.
I'm thinking of another bird that has the loon. And actually, Bob and Mercer said in northern Wisconsin, loons, they're common in most lakes.
Yep.
And their call is particularly...
Yep.
And that's as opposed... There's another kind of a warble that they do, which I think is...
Yep.
There's nothing like listening to
There's nothing like listening to loons. I think it's fantastic. And it's
so yeah. do birds have vocal cords?
They have syrinx, yes.
They have
what do you mean, sorry? Vocal cords. Yes, they do. They do have a bird version of vocal cords called syrinx. So this let these birds to kind of make these sounds by reverberating the bones there, just like shake in such a way that you can make these sounds.
Okay, so it's all right. So that's obviously quite different from what we've got.
Yeah, yeah.
Karen in Rice Lake has something. Let's go there. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I don't know where I heard this, but it was that bird songs affect our nervous system as people and then other animals possibly as well as a signal of safety. And then when the birds go quiet, we automatically are aware that something has changed or there may be danger. Could be a weather change or that a predator is near.
Huh. Quite interesting.
I think they might. Well, you know, if I thought someone was looking for me,
yeah, I mean,
like a hawk.
I'd
be quiet.
Well, I mean, there is, there are quite a lot of songbird species that don't call during a certain time of the time, and there are some, you know, there.
Nope.
So. Sorry.
No, that's right.
So there are some instances where birds might not call and sing because of the low pressure system when there's a approaching storm or something like that. So they might not be calling. You know, that's something that we have observed. A predator for a bird could be a different for a predator for a human. So yes, as you said, a hawk might be approaching or something else. So they might stop. Some calling.
And then other birds, let's take wild turkeys. Now, here in Wisconsin, we have a lot of turkeys.
Which is good, yeah.
And they will call, they have different calls depending on, well, that's a gobbler.
Yeah.
And they will have different calls sometimes to attract.
Yeah, so sometimes to attract a mate, and also sometimes as a warning call, which is some species go silent, and some species actually let out this warning call saying that yes, I can see the predator, I'm alerting the other species that are around. And interestingly, we did not use the calls of these species to do this study, so it was majorly on songs, But yeah, calls and repertoire of calls also are a big part of these species.
Mark emailed to ask if birds ever lose their voice when they catch a cold or something. Do they get laryngitis?
Like syringitis. I don't know. But I think sometimes they do lose their voice. I mean, it is all anecdotal, by the way. We do have a catbird that sings next to our house the whole night and even early morning, and I have no idea why. I mean, we know why, but it sings so much that at the end of the summer, sometimes it just has such a harsh voice, and we are like, it's okay, just relax. It's after the breeding season, so you can relax now, but it's like all harsh and scratchy. I mean, I know that I shouldn't be talking about anecdotal evidence, but sometimes right. You just look at these things and you're like, I think they might, it does put a lot of pressure on their sirens, and it does put a lot of pressure on their body system when they are calling. And there is something called environmental stress hypothesis, is that some individuals which are not fit enough might not call the same way than within the same species.
Yeah.
If one individual is living in the forest that has amazing food structure and amazing food and habitat, they might be fit enough to call louder and call for longer and call more times than the individuals that might be in a next door forest but might be disturbed and not have enough food. So, in a way, how we are and how fit we are does affect and how much we can call and how loud, you know, we can call. And yeah, so
that makes a lot of sense. Bob in Sparta says Bob has a whippoorwill behind his home that calls constantly and won't go away, depriving them of sleep.
I think it does. They might call a long time, and you know, it does deprive you of sleep. But sometimes I feel like, you know, I think people might lose their sleep over not listening to them, and I think that is something that, because then you can't get the species back, and I think that's more scary for me. Like, I might get annoyed by this, you know, one bird calling, you know, for example, the catbird that calls all the time, but I know that I will lose more sleep when I not listen to the catbird, because I know something has happened to them. And, yeah, and I think that's more scary. And I don't know.
That's a good point. Yeah. Christina in Glenwood City has something. Let's go there. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I am responding to the question about birds losing their voice. I have a canary, Sonny is his name. He has an incredibly beautiful voice.
Oh, fantastic.
However, when he molts once a year, in July, he loses his ability to sing. He tries, but he cannot until he's done with his molting.
Wow. That's a fantastic observation. Wow, that's amazing.
It's something there's nothing that you've looked at.
No.
All
yeah.
Set, yeah.
Well, that's amazing. Wow. Yeah, there'll be some. Wow, that is fantastic.
Thank
wow.
you, Christina.
Yeah.
Appreciate the call.
Yeah.
And you can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about bird songs today and some global research led by our guest today, Sathya Chandra Sagra, about bird songs and their meaning and how they vary depending on the bird species. It's been great talking with him today. And you can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. We had a song, a male ostrich has a very distinctive warning call. Ooh, ooh, ooh.
That's a fantastic call. I mean, you know, like, it's a very, very low frequency call, and you can hear that for kilometers, you know, and they live in such, you know, harsh conditions and in such open landscapes that they want to communicate with very, you know, various different species, so various different individuals of the same species. So they're like, well, you know, so that's a classic physics, right? If you sing at a very high frequency, the noise, the sound doesn't travel for further. So what it wants is it wants to make a really low frequency sound. So the low frequency sound travels much further. And thanks to its amazingly large body size, it can make this really low frequency sound. And
it's also flightless. Would that play would a flightless, and would there are other flightless birds, I guess?
Yes, yes.
I wonder if that was, if it might be, it's not unique at all to flightless birds?
You know, it's a great question, Larry.
Because
and
they
can't fly
away from danger.
Yeah, and I don't think I did not test that hypothesis, and I don't know whether that can hold good everywhere, but I don't know. I'll look into it, but definitely there are high frequency, smaller birds that are flightless in islands. So I don't know whether this is a specialty, but yeah. Yeah.
Roger in Sun Prairie has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Roger.
I got two things for you, Larry Mueller. One is, can you play the call of an ostrich or an emu or both? But the big thing I wanted to call about is you're earlier in this program, you were talking about birds losing their voice. Well, the turkey in the spring will gobble, and they gobble so much that towards the end of the breeding season, they barely can gobble at all. And we'll just, with the turkey, they have a real deep early, and then at the end, it's just.
Well, Roger, you might have just missed it because you were getting online, but we did just play an ostrich call.
Yeah, we did. That was fantastic. You know, coincidence. Wow.
I heard the turkey gobble, but not the end of his voice range when he ran out of gobble. So I didn't hear that.
Okay. Oh man.
But that's amazing. I mean, you know, you're able to, like, I mean, this is a fascinating thing about, like, you know, people loving bird songs. You go out and listen to them, and I think it just is magical. You know, I think it's,
Travis in Madison has something, too. Let's go there. Hi, Travis.
Hey, how's it going, gentlemen? I was just curious. You guys were talking about turkeys and stuff, and as a turkey hunter and stuff, I always thought it was fascinating that turkeys and crows have a relationship where they'll either check out a crow call if you make a crow call as a hunter, or vice versa. They kind of communicate with each other, and I thought that was always interesting, but didn't know much about it, and I thought maybe you guys might be able to tell me more.
So I should be honest and say I do not know these kind of relationships, particularly with a crow, with the turkey here. But however, those kind of mutual relationships does exist. And it doesn't mean I don't know them. I'm sure there are, like, people who might have studied this kind of relationships, but species, like, for example, in Asia and Africa, there are species like drongos. They make a warning call, and based on these calls, there are other species that either go out when there are, you know, no predators, for example, and they go out and, you know, are leisurely hunting and eating other things. But when the drongo makes a call and all the other animals are like, oh, you know, there's a falcon coming, or there's a hawk or an eagle, so let's just go back. So, yeah, so there is this mutual relationship between, you know, birds and other species, for example, meerkats. Yeah, so I wouldn't say no that this kind of exists, you know, a relationship doesn't exist, but I'm not very specifically don't know anything about, but it's fantastic to know. I think it'll be awesome to see. Yeah.
One of your takeaways from your research was that bird species living at the same latitudes make similar sounds.
So what the extension of that kind of...
Because you had a global study, so you were looking at latitudes.
Yeah, yeah. So what the extension of that kind of the thought was that that amongst, you know, like, species across the tropics will have very similar kind of, you know, like a frequency range.
Yeah.
You know, like, or frequency bandwidth, what we could say. And that bandwidth, which is similar across the tropics, will be very different in the temperate regions. So what we found was the bandwidth of the birds that are found in the tropical landscapes are much smaller than the bandwidth that we found of the species in the temperate landscape, like in Wisconsin or, compared to Costa Rica, for example. And we were like, you know, it makes sense. But one of the reasons that we got, you know, we thought was because of the high species diversity. You know, like Costa Rica or Panama or, for example, you know, parts in India have 2,000 species, 3,000 species of birds. And not, you know, not every bird can have different, there's only so much bandwidth that is exist that, you know, we can hear, you know, even the birds can listen to. So because of this high species diversity, they are always, you know, trying to have a very small niche, I would say, or a small bandwidth. It's like a symphony, for example. You know, if an orchestra has lots of equipment, all of them will play in a very, you know, very set frequency. But if there are only two people, three people playing instruments, you can play drums in a very low or, like, you know,
yeah,
high frequency. So and I think, you know, on a keyboard, for example. So I think that is what's happening. So more species, they all want to adjust. So and across, and that's, you can see that across you know, the tropics all across the temperate. Yeah.
Here's something interesting. Michael emailed to ask, can researchers estimate the frequencies produced by extinct birds larger than living birds, such as moas or elephant birds, terror birds?
That's a fantastic question. And I think, I mean, the science has gone so much that we could potentially say what frequencies that they are doing based on their bone structure or based on the size. And, you know, we could come to a point where this is the frequency that they're using. But what, I'm sorry, I'm going back again to the conservation of this and the loss of these species is because, for example, you know, like a dodo, you know, was still alive until recently, until we drove them to extinction. We could potentially say what frequency they were calling in, but we'll never know the song of the dodo because that modulation that it might be doing, the complexities that it might be bringing in. And I think that is lost forever. And I think yes and no. So one way we can know the frequency, but we can't really know how beautiful that song, what that bird could do with just that frequency, you know. And I think that's beautiful. I think also it's lost. So, yeah.
And Cheryl in Bessemer, Michigan, had a comment on brown thrashers, but just the smaller bird species. Why did they have a much wider range of frequencies? And you kind of went on, it talked about that a little bit, but maybe expand on that for us. You know, the more vulnerable birds tend to have a wider range.
Yeah. So the smaller bird, I mean, you know, so what we found was like the smaller birds tend to kind of also, while they are, you know, through the body mass and beak size, they tend to have higher frequency notes, but they also try to make lower frequency calls, you know, lower than what you would predict, you know, what their song would be. And that is just, you know, that is one of the hypotheses called is size exaggeration, you know. So, and I think if you're exaggerating your size, because over the years, species adapt to a certain rhythm of the nature. You know, they'll know that, okay, that call or that song at this frequency means, you know, it could be an ostrich or a large bird. But, and in nature, it's always a race for survival, you know. It's always a race for survival. So in a way that, you know, in that race, they're trying to be like, okay, you know, we could make ourselves look or seem bigger, despite not being. And I think, you know, that's fascinating. And I think that shows the complexities of these.
Well, in our last minute or so, what's next for you here? I mean, I'm sure you've got so much data to work with.
Yeah, and I think one of the next things that we are trying to do is relate these frequency characteristics to their threatened status. You know, someone just asked about the extinct species, and we are trying to see if, like, critically endangered or endangered birds, do they seem to have a certain frequencies, you know? So this comes with an hypothesis that usually large-bodied species tend to be more threatened towards extinction, either because they need, you know, they have very large life cycles or need large habitats to survive, or they're good meat. So in a lot of people have hunted down to extinction or to being very endangered. So we're trying to see if just by looking at the species frequency in a forest, can we say, well, these groups of species that are having, for example, low frequency might be more threatened, is something that we want to do in the future. And and another one would be to try and understand not just the frequency characteristics, but also the temporal characteristics. You know, now we just looked at the frequency, but we can see you know, how the rate of complexity changes. So that's the next.
That's the next. Satya, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And I hope we have a chance to do this again. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for all the listeners. And it's been a pleasure of mine to study the birds and also share this wonderful story. Thank you so much.
Satya Chandra Sagra, our guest today, conservation scientist and recent PhD graduate from the UW-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Pleasure to have him with And a pleasure to have you listening in. And thanks so much for listening. And stay with us. Lots more in store on WPR News.